Welcome to Central Time, WPR's brand new talk show. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's 3:06 and you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today on Central Time, we'll hear about a Waukesha native who is part musician, part inventor, and all-around Wisconsin legend. Yeah, we're talking about Les Paul. That's coming up later in the hour.
We'll also talk with an author who says that if you think money can't buy happiness, you're just not buying the right stuff.
I think it means you need to start buying me some stuff, Rickert.
Yeah, keep dreaming. But you can ask him when we talk with him in about 15 minutes.
First, though, we found out yesterday in the news that the National Security Agency has secretly been collecting telephone records of Verizon customers in the United States. Then later in the day, we learned that it's not just our phones being mined, but also data from tech firms like Google, Facebook, and Apple.
And that's got Mark Rummeld concerned. He's a staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and he says this is confirmation that the NSA is spying on millions of Americans. Mark, welcome to Central Time. And so, Mark, this is huge breaking news. The NSA is watching us. First, there was the Verizon phone data story, now PRISM, the acronym for the Internet Data Collection Revelation. Catch us up on what we need to know on this one.
Right. Well, so I'll start with the disclosure about the Verizon phone records. On, I think, Wednesday night, The Guardian published an order by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that directed Verizon to turn over the call record information for all of its customers for a specific, I think it was a two-month or so period. While I think this is surprising to the general public, this is actually not entirely surprising to those that have followed this closely. EFF has had a lawsuit pending against the National Security Agency since 2008 in an attempt to get them to have a judge review the program and to determine that it was unconstitutional. The government has tried to block that lawsuit at every possible step by saying the program was classified or that state secrets prohibited its disclosure. But the release of that order on Wednesday and then yesterday, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, confirmed that the order was real and that the program is, in fact, exactly what we thought. And that's the NSA collecting the communication records of essentially all American telephone communications.
So the cat's out of the bag on that one, but I gather the government is also saying that, you know, this isn't exactly new. It's new to the American public, but Congress has known about this for years.
Right. Well, so I think the amount that Congress has known about the program is being significantly overstated by the administration. There certainly are specific members of Congress, specific senators who have been read into the program and read into the program for a long time. Dianne Feinstein and Saxby Chambliss are two. They were read into the program when it was under the Bush administration. So that if you look, those are the two who came out and said, "Oh, this isn't a big problem. Don't worry about this." But on the other hand, there are some elected officials like Senator Ron Wyden who since 2008 have said when the American public finds out about this, they are going to be stunned and they are going to be angry. And so there's definitely some opposition within Congress. And then I think there's probably just whole swaths of both the Senate and House that haven't ever heard of the program at all.
So let's talk a little bit about how the American public did find out about this. Where did it come from and why did it break now?
Well, so it's unclear how the Guardian obtained the order, but presumably it was some form of leak that was provided to Glenn Greenwald in the Guardian, and they published it on Wednesday.
And as far as the American public kicking and screaming, are we seeing that response now? Is this as big as it's going to get? What's going to happen next?
You know, I think it's problems. I think the administration has big problems on its hands. James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, was asked by Senator Ron Wyden in a very direct question, is the NSA collecting data, just any information about millions of Americans? And James Clapper said no. And, you know, there's no question now that that Verizon order has been released that he was lying. And the thing, the most important thing about that is that Senator Wyden knew the answer to that question. Hmm. He wasn't asking for his own benefit. He was asking for the benefit of the American public. And so we shouldn't take DNI Clapper's response as a lie to Senator Wyden. We should take that as a lie to us, because that's exactly what it was.
Well, and House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers said yesterday that the NSA program did already help thwart a significant case, as he put it, of terrorism in the U.S. within the last few years, and that case hasn't been made public yet.
Right.
You know, if it is made public, if it exists, if it happened and we were made safer, what's that going to change?
Well, so that's part of the problem. Like, it's fine for Representative Rogers to say that, but without any evidence for the public to look at and to assess and to decide if we're willing to accept this level of surveillance in our country in order to thwart, you know, a potential terrorist attack. I mean, that's exactly the type of public debate about the program that needs to happen. And, you know, if we decide, yes, this is where we want to draw the line, and, you know, that it's consistent with the Constitution, you know, then that's part of the democratic process. But that process never occurred. This process, drafting of these laws, the interpretation of the laws, and the implementation of the laws has occurred entirely in secret.
And so that's your beef with it, really, that this has happened in secret, that we didn't get to have this public conversation about it.
Right. Well, you know, that's part of my beef with it. I think having a public discussion about it is the first step. I do think that the collection and the retention of the communication records of millions and millions of Americans is actually, I think it's unconstitutional. I think it violates the First Amendment and the Fourth Amendment, and I think it violates even FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the authority that the order was issued under.
Now, predictably, the White House has defended this, and President Obama has said that he welcomes that discussion on the trade-offs between civil liberties and security, and that's part of the crux of it. But can you flesh out a little for us what's at stake as we try to answer that question?
Well, I'm happy to hear President Obama say that he welcomes the discussion. I hope he intends to make it a public discussion. As I said before, you know, doing it in closed sessions of Congress is, we've seen that the American public doesn't trust Congress to draw those lines for us. We clearly don't trust the executive branch alone to draw those lines. We need public input on it. Aspect that I'd like to touch on is the way it's framed, right? It's President Obama calls it a trade-off between privacy and security, but it's not always the case that the two are mutually exclusive. And I think you know, framing it in that way is representative of the administration's mindset when they're approaching the question. And I think that's another aspect that a public dialogue, that people bringing in, you know, advocates for civil liberties, security experts, I think that can really help the process, and it, you know, can help the country move forward in a way that's consistent with the law, that's consistent with the Constitution, and that's consistent with national security.
And Mark, before we go, where do you see the story going from here?
Well, if what I've heard is correct, the Guardian has more information that it is planning to release. So I'm not certain that we've seen the end of the information leaked. My hope, my sincere hope on the NSA's domestic surveillance program is that the program is ended as currently run. That you know, we start from scratch and we figure out a way to conduct the type of intelligence investigations that our country needs to stay safe, while at the same time excluding the private and constitutionally protected communications of the American public.
Well, I know you'll be watching it closely, and so will the rest of us. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Mark Rummel, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
In just a minute, we'll talk about how money might be able to buy us happiness after all. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Monday morning at 7, it's the State Capitol Report with Joy Cardine and reporter Sean Johnson. They'll spend the hour breaking down what came out of this week's budget action in the state legislature.
And here's a check of the latest headlines. President Barack Obama is assuring Americans that, quote, nobody is listening to your telephone calls. Speaking today at a healthcare event in San Jose, California, he defended the collection of millions of phone records in the U.S. and the monitoring of some internet activity overseas through U.S. internet companies. He says the surveillance is a necessary defense against terrorism. Pakistani intelligence officials say a suspected U.S. drone strike has killed 7 militants near the Afghan border. Many Pakistanis oppose U.S. drone strikes because they say the strikes kill large numbers of innocent civilians, something the U.S. denies. The country's new prime minister has lashed out against the U.S. drone program and called for an end to it. University of Wisconsin System Regents have approved a proposal that could eventually lead to pay raises for all system employees. The proposal involves asking that UW system employees be included in any salary hikes given to all state employees. And the regents are requesting that the UW system be given autonomy to provide further salary increases from its own resources. You can catch up on more news coming up at 3:30.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. On Sunday night, the internet went crazy with people yelling, cursing, in general gnashing their teeth, and all because of what happened on the HBO program Game of Thrones, which has been described as a mashup between The Lord of the Rings and The Sopranos.
We don't want to spoil anything, but something bad happened to a character or characters on the show. Here are a couple of the tweets reacting to what happened. Quote, I wanted to tweet 5 minutes ago about watching this week's Game of Thrones, but I couldn't because I was sobbing an ocean of tears.
And here's another one, in all caps, by the way. I've never felt so heartbroken over a fictional family. Game of Thrones, quit playing games with my heart, damn you.
Well, here's our question with you. That got us thinking, why do we feel so connected to fictional characters? Is there a fictional character in a book, movie, or TV show that you felt an attachment to? Let us know, and we could read your comment on the air. Go to the Central Time Facebook page or send your email to talk@wpr.org. Well, as the saying goes, money can't buy happiness, but not everybody agrees with that.
That's right. Michael Norton of Harvard's Business School says that there are ways we can spend our money that might actually make us happier.
Michael's latest book, co-authored with Elizabeth Dunn, is called Happy Money: The Science of Smarter Spending. In it, he gives us a new way of looking at the relationship between cash and happiness. We'll be taking your calls during this interview. You can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we talk about ways money can buy happiness, there's a way it can't. Do we get happier just by virtue of having more money?
Unfortunately, even though we all keep trying to make more and more money, it turns out the research shows that more and more money doesn't make us less happy, but after a while, it doesn't really make us that much more happy.
So what can we do with our money? And this is what you spend a lot of time on in the book. What can we do with our money to use it to make us happier?
One of the things is basically whatever you're using it for is probably wrong, which is what we have tried to tell people. So research shows when people make more money, what are the things they do? Well, they buy a bigger house, they buy a new car, they buy a bigger TV. They buy stuff and stuff and stuff, and they tend to buy it for themselves. And all of those things, again, just like making more money, they don't make you less happy, but they don't make you more happy. And all of the things we encourage people to do are thinking outside of buying things for yourself and more about what else, of all the things in the world, what else could you do with your money to get more happiness out of it?
We'll talk about the ways to spend that money better in a minute, but first, how do we measure this? We don't have happiness meters that we can plug people into as they're spending money.
We don't yet, but we're working on them.
So what do you do? Right. How do you set up an experiment to measure that?
We do. So one of the things we can do is literally ask people on a scale how happy they are. And it sounds like a crazy question. So if I said on a scale from 1 to 72, 1 is not happy and 72 is I'm as happy as I've ever been, you could answer that question, actually. Probably you came up with a number like 63 in your head right away. And it seems strange to say 63 because who knows what that means. But it turns out if I ask you next year how happy you are, you're probably still kind of a 63. If something bad happened to you, you're probably below that. And if something good happened, you're probably above it. So even though these numbers that we ask people seem kind of random, we can use them to really understand how well you're doing in your life. And when we tell you to spend your money in different ways, we can measure what's the best way to move you around from your 63.
And now you mentioned that we might buy that thing that we're hoping makes us happier, but it doesn't. What should we buy instead of that, I don't know, flat screen TV?
One of the easiest shifts to make in spending actually is from buying stuff to buying experiences. So sometimes we confuse the two. So we think when we buy a TV that what we're buying are wonderful nights with the family watching movies or a Super Bowl party with all of our friends. And that's true, but what we're really buying with a TV is hundreds of hours staring at a screen by ourselves. It's not a great experience when you buy a TV. If you took that money and invested it instead in an experience, both big experiences like a vacation, but also little ones like meals out or even lunch with a friend, those kinds of experiences, lots of research has shown, make you happier while you're doing them. And then when you think back on them, they make you happy all over again. You remember the great vacation you had. You don't really remember the TV you had 10 years ago. It's not that interesting. The experiences that we have are what make us happier in the long run.
And you don't remember the experience of watching 100 hours of TV in a week positively either?
If you do, you'll have a very boring life.
Well, maybe it's a really good show. I don't know.
That could be. Maybe Sopranos.
Exactly. Well, maybe a lot of us might feel reluctant to plunk down the money on an experience, on a big vacation. It's not something we get to keep and hold on to in the long run. When it's done, it's done. How do we make that shift in mindset toward appreciating that maybe that's a better use of our resources than that item that we get to keep and keep using?
It's so hard to make the shift because you think and we're told that buying things is a smart investment, like buying a house. Is a physical thing and you own it and then you can sell it later and it just feels like it's going to be a better purchase for your happiness. But it turns out if you think about when you buy a house, once you buy it, it just kind of gets worse and worse because the roof starts to leak and you've got to redo the driveway and all of these things get worse and worse. So even though you have the thing, it's actually getting kind of negative over time. With experiences, weirdly enough, when you have the thing, it's nice. And our mind plays funny tricks on us where experiences get better and better in our memory over time. So you went on a vacation 20 years ago, and on the vacation, actually, the plane was late and somebody got sick and all these bad things happened. 20 years later, all you remember is how romantic it was to be with your girlfriend at the time. Our brains make experiences better over time precisely because we don't have the physical thing. Sometimes having the physical thing is what ruins our happiness because we can look at it and see it getting worse and worse.
But when we're out shopping for something like, let's say, a house, and we think that extra few hundred square feet, it's going to be a better experience to live there, right? So how does that pan out?
We do think this a lot. I always say, people are saying we need a fifth guest bedroom. And the question is, for who? You know, if you don't have any friends, you don't really need that many guest bedrooms. But the other thing about buying a big house is very often when you buy a big house, it's further from your place of work. And when you move further from your place of work, you know what's coming, hours and hours of commuting. And you might think this bigger house is going to make you happy because it's going to be such an amazing experience, but what you're really going to be doing is sitting in a car in traffic and not enjoying that house. So another thing that we tell people to do is when you're thinking about making a purchase, don't just think about the thing you're buying, think about how it will affect your time. And very often buying a big house that makes you commute 2 hours each way every day feels like it's a good investment because you'll be happy in the house, but really what you're committing yourself to is hours of being frustrated on the highway.
Michael Norton of Harvard's Business School is with us to talk about ways we can spend our money that actually can make us happier. We want to hear from you. Do you spend money on experiences instead of things? Was there a time you spent money on something that you thought would make you happier? Did it work out that way? Post on the Central Time Facebook page or give us a call at 800-642-1234. Michael, give us a little tease before we go to the news. Sarah Silverman taught you a lesson that we'll pick up after the news. What was it?
Use fart jokes sparingly.
And that speaks to the idea of, instead of getting that thing you like again and again, we turn it into a treat, right?
That's right. So whatever you think is funniest or most enjoyable in the entire world, instead of using it all the time, like comedians use fart jokes, take a break from it and you'll like it more when you come back to it.
We'll talk about that more coming up in just a few minutes after the news, and we'll talk about how that applies to my daily donut habit. Again, you can join in, 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, with your thoughts on how money can or cannot buy happiness. Also, hey, it's a brand new show. You can check out the Central Time Facebook page, and be sure to follow Central Time on Twitter.
You're listening to the Ideas Network as we take Central Time to you for the very first time, and we'll be taking your phone calls when we come back from the break. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. We want to know what you think. Does money buy happiness? How does it work for you?
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the first pilot of Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We'll pick up our talk now with Michael Norton, co-author of the new book, Happy Money. He says money spent wisely, the right way, can buy our happiness. What do you think? Give a call at 800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. But Michael, we mentioned treats going into the news. They had these really good donuts at the grocery store next door with raspberry cream in the middle. And the first time I had one, it was great. When I had one the next day, it was pretty good. And then when I had mine for the 15th weekday in a row, it was okay. What's going on there? What lesson can I learn from that?
There's a curse. I wish I had one of those right now. There's a curse of being human, which is that the things that we like the best, even though we never really come to hate them, we do get a little bit sick of them over time, just like those donuts that you had. You see this actually when you do binge watching of TV shows as well. Still the 19th episode that you watch in a row and it's, you know, 4 in the morning and you can't stop, it's still great, but it's not quite as good as the one you watched at the beginning because we adapt to things and get used to them. So we tell people basically when you feel yourself starting to get used to things, take a little bit of a break from it. Could be an hour, could be a week. And when you come back, a lot of research shows that you can actually sort of reinvigorate the excitement of the very first time that you had it and get more happiness out of it.
So take a donut holiday and then come back and it's a treat again.
Exactly.
We'll go to the phones now. We've got Libby in Madison with us. Libby, hi. You're the first caller ever on Central Time. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I feel honored. I wanted to say that I understand why not struggling to put food on the table, not being in a position where money is truly an issue every day could make you happier. But I also wanted to point out the existence of the internet meme, the phenomenon of first world problems. And I think that that's sort of a manifestation of how even people who are incredibly financially comfortable still find things that give them anxiety or stress, that when they say them out loud, they are able to objectively say, well, this is a first world problem. This is something that isn't really that big of a deal in the scheme of things, but it's still something that seems to provide a lot of stress and anxiety for people. So I'm curious about the author's thoughts on that as well.
Libby, thanks for the call. And Michael, she brought up two really interesting points. I thought first, at some point, if we don't have enough money, enough resources, that can lead to unhappiness. There's a threshold, isn't there?
That's right. So it is absolutely the case that people who are quite poor, if they make more income, it does in fact lead to an increase in happiness. Estimates vary, but in the United States right now, it looks that around $50,000 to $75,000 a year of income is the point at which more income doesn't make you that much happier. But the caller is absolutely right that before that point, of course, people who have to worry about paying their bills, the stress of that really does hurt your happiness. At the other end of the scale, though, people who have a lot of money and we think that their problems are solved, one of the things we forget is often people who have a lot of money foolishly go into a lot of debt, and then they're worried about their money. Even though they have more, they're still just as worried about paying off those debts. And it's a curse, really, of making more and more money is we think that when we get more, we'll finally be happy with what we have, but then we structure our lives so we have to keep worrying about it all over again.
And yeah, and that's Libby's second point. Even if we're not worried about putting food on the table, we're going to find something. We can't afford that big mortgage we've taken on, or how are we going to pay for college? And the stress there is as much or almost as much.
That's right. And you know, one of the things that we really try to emphasize in the book is that sometimes we think big things are going to be what change our lives, you know, that if I get this amazing new job or this amazing new house or if my income doubles, that's what will make me happy. And very often it's the little things in life that actually make us much happier. So when we talk about, for example, as we said earlier, the value of buying experiences, we don't just mean wealthy people going on month-long vacations to Europe. We also mean regular people like us going out for a lunch with a coworker and you know, $5 or $10 of an experience, many, many more people can afford those kinds of experiences. And those little experiences every day make us much, much happier as well.
Thanks a lot for the call, Libby. We'll go now to Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I find it very interesting that you are two men discussing this topic. I think it might have been much better presented with a woman and a man. And so I'm going to give you my woman's point of view, and that is, looking back on my life, what I would have spent my money on, and now have to spend my money on because I'm no longer able to do certain things, and I'm referring to services. As a young mother, I would have loved a diaper service. I would have loved someone to just take children off my hands for a certain portion of the week on a very regular basis. I would have loved someone to do the shopping, at least occasionally. I would have loved, and now definitely have to hire the services of a lot of doing things that ordinarily in the past I would have been able to do. But I find I can't believe that you're discussing this as two men. You need a woman in this mixture.
Well, that's
you know,
that's,
two men probably have not been involved in the running of a household the way a woman has been in the past.
Thank you for providing a woman's perspective, Nancy. And of course, your co-author Michael is a woman, so there's that perspective in your book. But Nancy brought up a great point that we haven't gotten to yet: the idea of using our money to buy time.
She's absolutely right, and you're also right that my co-author, Liz Dunn, is a woman. And in fact, when we were writing the book, Liz was pregnant with her first child, a son who was just born recently. In fact, we had to finish the book by her due date so that she didn't have to deal with it when she had a newborn. One of the things that Liz did with following the advice in the book was actually her son, Ollie, was having trouble sleeping. She hired someone to come in to help teach Ollie how to sleep at night. It was a very expensive service to come in, actually, as the caller was suggesting. It made an enormous difference in her life, and they took the money for that from other expenditures, like, you know what, let's not have coffee and donuts all day this week. Let's give that up in favor of using the money to buy ourselves better time, and in this case, the most important kind of time, which is actually sleep.
And when we start changing our mindset to think of the idea of making those investments to buy time, how does that change the way we look at how we spend our money?
It should radically change how you spend your money. You know, when we think about buying things, the first thing we think is, you know, the good things about what we're going to do with that, and we tend to not think so much about the negative things that will do. One of the examples that we use is if you think about buying a pet. Often people say, you know what, I'm just going to buy a goldfish because it won't take much time and I don't have to take care of it that much and it's not going to bug me, as opposed to a dog where I have to take it for a walk and I'll go to the park and all these things that will take up too much time. And that's the wrong way to think about it, actually, because if you have a goldfish, yeah, it doesn't cost much money, but it doesn't change your time at all. It just sits there. If you buy a dog, it costs a little bit more money, but dogs actually make you go exercise when you take the dog for a walk, and that's good for happiness. And because dogs like to interact with other dogs, you also chat with other dog owners. And chatting with other people is actually good for happiness as well. So we don't think about the act of buying a dog as committing us to exercise, which is great time, and socializing, which is great time. But when you think about your purchases and how they'll affect your time overall, suddenly a dog seems like a wise investment and a goldfish seems like a waste of money.
One more point I wanted to get to. You talk about the idea of spending money on other people to make us happier. How does that work?
This is one of the, I think, most obvious and also most non-obvious principles that we suggest, which is basically we've done a lot of research to show that on a given day, if you've got an extra $5, if you spend it on yourself, not much is going to happen for your happiness. You know, you'll buy a coffee, you'll buy a sandwich as you usually do. Why would that change your life? If we ask people or even force people to spend it on somebody else, you know, give it to charity, give it to a homeless person, treat a friend to lunch, those people actually become happier at the end of the day. And we've seen it in countries all over the world. So we've looked in the United States, in Canada, in Uganda, in South Africa, in India. Everywhere we look, spending money on other people is much better for happiness than using that money for yourself.
In our last minute with you today, you've been working on this book for a while. What's the biggest way it changed your life, researching this stuff?
It goes back to your donuts, actually. I think making it a treat is one of the hardest things to put into play. So I know that if I quit things I like this week, I'll be happier next week when I come back to them. And it's a little bit like, I know if I exercise this week, I'll be happier next week. But every day when I look at my running shoes, I don't want to do it. And every day when I look at that donut, I want to eat it. And if you train yourself to think about using your money in ways that maximize your time, it really changes a lot of your decisions. And for me, it actually involves giving things up a little bit and then coming back to them and liking them more.
Michael Norton, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Michael Norton, co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Smarter Spending. And next up, we'll explore the life of Wisconsin legend Les Paul. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, friends, the clock at my left tells me that it's time for the 4-H Club of the Air.
Our mission at Wisconsin Public Radio is to create programs by, for, and about the people of Wisconsin. Including WPR in your will is a great way to recognize how much your life is enriched by the programs you listen to and to enrich the lives of future generations. To learn more about making a planned gift, call 800-747-7444 or visit our new planned giving web resource at legacy.wpr.org. Coming up Monday after 3, At Issue is back, and John Munson will talk to author David Grotto about healthy and delicious summer food. That's Monday at 3 on At Issue.
Right now, here are a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon. Several people are reported to be wounded after someone opened fire near the campus of California's Santa Monica College today. Police say the wounded include the shooter, who's reported to be in custody. Officers have been searching the campus after witnesses said there may have been a second shooter. The location is about 3 miles from where President Obama has been appearing at a fundraiser. Prosecutors are recommending 4 years in prison for former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. following his guilty plea this year on criminal charges that he engaged in a scheme to spend $750,000 in campaign funds on personal items. He is scheduled to be sentenced on July 3rd, along with his wife, Sandra. She pleaded guilty to filing false joint federal income tax returns that understated the income the couple received. Here in Wisconsin, a Milwaukee attorney is angry over a provision adopted by the legislature's budget committee that would further tighten Wisconsin's civil litigation rules. Peter Earle represents 171 children who sued six lead pigment manufacturers whose products allegedly made them sick. The lawsuits filed between 2006 and 2011 are still pending in federal and state courts, might all be nullified under the provision. We'll hear more news coming up at 4 o'clock. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. That's the sound of Les Paul, who we can pretty much thank for coming up with the signature sound of rock and roll when he invented the solid body electric guitar.
We're talking about Les Paul now on this, our very first Wisconsin Legends segment, where we talk with and about Wisconsinites who have made a difference in the world. A new Les Paul exhibit opens this weekend at the Waukesha County Museum, so we're taking the chance to take a look back at his life and music.
Sue Baker is the program director of the Les Paul Foundation and a close personal friend of his, too. She joins us now. Sue, welcome to Central Time. And Sue, are you with us? Checking on that phone line there. And in the meantime, thinking about Les Paul and this new exhibit that's opening in Waukesha. Sue Baker, a personal friend of his. Now, this guy had an incredible life. He was an inventor, and he also came through many, many personal physical hardships that were, you know, they're pretty inspiring. And as soon as we get Sue on the line, she'll tell us about those. We're going to try to get her back with us. And, you know, Rob?
As a musician, I'm always impressed by people who are musicians and inventors, the people who develop the technology that I use and don't understand a bit of. So that's Les Paul is really a legend in my mind.
And let's see if we've got Sue Baker with us. Sue, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. So glad to hear your voice. So, you know, to me, Les Paul seems like this larger-than-life figure. He was a personal friend to you, but he was also this huge personality. Can you tell us about him through the eyes of a friend?
Oh, he was amazing. I think what impressed me most was his humanity, if you will. I mean, here, like you said, he's this bigger-than-life person, but everyone who ever had a chance to meet him always walked away and said he was so down-to-earth, he was so welcoming. He would very easily approach anybody. I mean, one time he would be talking to a star who all of us would recognize, and he'd turn around and he'd talk to the cleaning lady, and he would have the same amount of respect in his voice. And that was so big in my book.
Where did that come from, that personal touch that he would take to just connect with people wherever he was? Do you have a sense of where that came from in him?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, people from the coast would say he never lost that Midwestern touch. He always was that guy from Wisconsin, the guy from Waukesha. He never forgot where he came from. He, you know, some of your listeners might know that when he was growing up, he lived with his mom and his older brother, and they didn't have a lot of money. He came from humble beginnings, and he remembered that, and so he didn't look down on anybody, no matter where they were coming from.
Now, I think it's fair to say that we can pretty much thank Les Paul for the sound that is rock and roll. And he was also an amazing guitarist himself. What was it like hearing him play?
Absolutely. Well, I didn't know him until his last 10 years of his life. That's when I met him. So he wasn't doing that lightning speed playing, but I certainly, like your listeners, have seen it on YouTube and have seen him in various, videos and films. Just anybody, even if you're not a guitar player, to watch him play when he was at his peak in the early 1950s is just amazing, so fast. And when you look at his face, you can tell he's just having a great time doing it.
And from the sound of it, I mean, as you can understand, playing guitar was incredibly important to him. Now, I know that he went through a lot of challenges physically, and there were moments, it sounds like, where he didn't know if he was going to be able to play again, but he always came back. Can you talk a little bit about what he went through and what he went through to keep playing?
Well, absolutely. You hit it right on the head. He had multiple challenges, and I find it amusing because sometimes people say to me, oh, Les Paul led a charmed life. He didn't. He didn't. He had lots and lots of challenges. One of the first, he was in his 20s when he was playing his electric guitar, and he said, oh, so foolishly, he reached in to turn some knobs on a piece of electrical equipment, and he had a tremendous, tremendous electrical shock, lost the use of his hands, and he was hospitalized, and the doctors at that time said, you may not get the use of your hands back. And he was just, you know, in his 20s at that point, and he was determined he would get the use of his hands back. Must be that Wisconsin German in him. And he did what he had to do. He worked, he said, I kept exercising my fingers. I was bound and determined to get them back. He did. And then in 1948, and he would have been in his 30s at that point, he was in this horrific, horrific car accident where, and this was before seatbelts, and he and Mary Ford were driving on an AC bridge, and they slipped off the bridge. They were in a convertible, so they both went through the roof. They wound up, the car wound up upside down in a riverbed, and they were both thrown. Mary was okay, but Les broke his back. He broke his His arm, his right arm, his elbow was shattered. They thought they were going to amputate it, which, of course, for a guitar player, that's not too good. Very long story, but it took him a year and a half to recover. He obviously, they found a doctor who worked with him. In fact, he had multiple surgeries, spent a year and a half recovering. But, again, he was determined he would play. And I think one of the things that impressed me about Les, one time I was talking to him on the phone, and he said, you know, he told me about the accident. He said, I was the luckiest guy in the world, and he kept talking. And I said, whoa, wait, back up, Les. Okay, you just told me you almost died in this accident. They were going to amputate your arm, and you're telling me you're the luckiest guy in the world? Wait a minute. This isn't adding up for me. Come back and explain. And he said, don't you understand? I was going way too fast in my life, and I never would have stopped and looked at my life, but the accident forced me to stop, and I had a year and a half to not only think about what I had done, but also to plan ahead what I wanted to do. And he said, and as I was lying in that hospital bed, he said, I was designing all sorts of things in my head. He said, I did all kinds of reading. I read about psychology. I read about electronics. And he said, I learned so much. And, you know, that was something that was so amazing about Les, is no matter what happened to him, he always looked and he found the good part of it. And he, that's what he focused on, was the good part. And then he had a heart attack and he had bypass surgery. And you know, at the very front end, he was one of the first people to get a pacemaker. But he just kept going. And then, of course, most people know about the arthritis, where at the end he could only move one of his fingers. It's hard to play a guitar when only one finger moves.
Such an incredible, inspiring life, though. I mean, it's amazing. Did he ever tell you how he came up with the idea for that solid body electric guitar?
Oh, yes. And you know what was really cool is he did that as a teenager when he still lived in Waukesha. He had an acoustic guitar, but he didn't like how when he plucked the strings that there was that resonance in the guitar and inside the body. And he said, you know, I didn't want that. When I plucked the string, I just wanted to hear the string and nothing else. And so he started by stuffing all sorts of things into his guitar. You know, he said, I took a tablecloth and I took rags and I took shorts and I stuffed them in there. And he said the sound was terrible. And he said, so then I poured plaster of Paris in and ruined my guitar. And you can actually see this in Discovery World in Milwaukee, and you can see the story in Waukesha in that exhibit as well. But then he decided that after the plaster of Paris and ruining the guitar, he got another acoustic guitar. But then he said, I needed to find the most dense piece of material I could think of. And he said, I tried a piece of wood. I didn't like that. Well, Les lived across the street from railroad tracks. And at that point in the 1920s, when there was a piece of damaged rail, they would cut it out and just throw it under the bridge. So he convinced some of his buddies to go get this piece of rail and drag it up. And the first solid body electric guitar was made with a piece of rail from a railroad track.
Wow.
So that's where it started. And, of course, he called his mother in and said, Mama, you got to come see this. I invented this new guitar. And his mom, who was his biggest advocate, came in, looked at the guitar and said, Lester, now tell me when you're going to see a cowboy riding on a horse with a chunk of rail. I don't think so.
Well, see, we're running low on time. Man, I love these stories. I wish we could talk all day. But as we go out here, we've got about 30 seconds. Tell me a little bit about what he meant to Waukesha.
Well, he meant everything, and Waukesha is celebrating their favorite son. I would encourage your listeners to come out to the Waukesha County Museum, see the exhibit. Be sure to visit the Les Paul Memorial. Les is buried in Prairie Home Cemetery. And go on the Les Paul Foundation website. It's www.lespaulfoundation.org. Tons of stories. I write at least one a month, and we post them and just keep having fun stories, information on Les.
Oh, well, it's wonderful. Sue, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure.
Well, you're welcome. I enjoyed sharing Les Paul with your listeners.
Sue Baker is the program director at the Les Paul Foundation, where she also blogs and shares stories about Les Paul. And we've got a link to her blog on the Central Time Facebook page and on Twitter.
And if you've got a Wisconsin legend you'd like to see featured during this segment, tell us about them while you're there.
There's much more Central Time just ahead, including a piece from WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach that takes a closer look at the Les Paul exhibits in the Milwaukee area. That's coming up in about 20 minutes. Right now, though, we'll have Les take us out with his absolute favorite song to play live. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.